Welcome to the City Confessions. I'm Marianne Yip, a native New Yorker, and I'm here to discuss all the thoughts that go through the minds of people living in New York City. Since I'm a native who was born and raised in the city that never sleeps, I come across people who are constantly in a rush. I would like to take a moment to sit down and talk about what's on their minds and what keeps them up at night. So sit back and let's dive into these confessions of people I know and people I just met. Hi guys, welcome back to season 4 of the City Confessions. I am so excited that we are back and running. And today's first guest to start off the season is Gabby Shaknai. She is a New York-based journalist and editor who covers beauty and wellness, food and travel and lifestyle. And her work has appeared in Fortune, Elle, Travel and Leisure, Is Women's Health, and many others. So, hi Gabby, how are you?
Hi, I'm well, how are you?
Great. I know that we were trying to get you on for the last season, so thank you so much for following up and kicking this season off.
Of course, thank you so much for having me.
So why don't we begin by having you introduce yourself and tell the listeners a little bit about your background, what you do, and your relationship with New York City.
Sure. So like Marianne said, I am a journalist based here in New York. I actually grew up in Arizona, so the other side of the country, but I always felt the most at home here in New York. And my dad is from New York originally, so I spent a lot of time here growing up and kind of knew that as soon as I could, I would be here. With that said, though, I did go to the UK for my undergrad and my first master's. So I got a little international exposure on the way, but I've been in New York for, gosh, like 3 or 4 years since then. And I've been writing for a number of publications. I cover beauty, wellness, arts, food and travel, and just kind of consumer-facing business.
That's amazing. But I'm really, really intrigued by you choosing to go to the University of Edinburgh. Why?
Yeah, you know, it's really kind of a weird question. And truthfully, I had never actually been to Scotland before I chose to go there. But my stepfather is English, so I spent a lot of time in England growing up. Mm. And I really knew very early on, I'd say around age 12, exactly what I wanted to study and exactly what I wanted to do as a career. So I really didn't want to waste my time with the general ed requirements that are so ubiquitous to American universities. And I had spent the summer before my senior year of high school in England taking some classes at Oxford. And so I applied to a few schools there, kind of just, you know, on an off chance, on a whim. And that was in addition to all of my schools here in the US. And I had actually already committed to going to a school in New York. Wow. And then I got into the University of Edinburgh, which I had really only applied to because I knew that they had an excellent English program and it seemed like a cool enough place, but I, again, didn't know a thing about it. So when I first got accepted, I was just kind of thinking, oh, okay, that's cool, like, it's flattering. But the more I looked into it, the more it seemed like a very good option for me. And I ultimately decided that I wanted to go there. And I had never visited, even before arriving there for the school year in September. It was an interesting experience. I really enjoyed my first year or two there, but I think my heart has always been in New York and has always been in very big cities. So although Edinburgh is the capital of Scotland, it's just not the same feel. I always tell people it's a great place to visit for a few days, maybe not to live there for several years, but it really enabled me to travel all over Europe and to meet so many people from all over the world. So I'm very thankful for that, but I'm also very glad it's over.
No, I can totally relate because I actually studied abroad in London. So okay. I did go to Scotland. Obviously, it's right there. But my abroad was a semester. So I can only imagine spending 4 years there. And that's very bold and brave of you to kind of just pack your bags and have never visited prior and say, hey, I'm going to spend the next 4 years here studying English. So kudos to you.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think it was definitely the right decision for me at the time. I was very frustrated with America, and especially the West Coast, and really just wanted to get away. And I loved the appeal of Europe and kind of avoiding the Greek system and all of the qualms of American college.
Right. So you mentioned that you knew exactly what you wanted to do at age 12. A lot of people at that age probably don't. So why don't you walk me through, I guess, how did you find your passion for writing, and where do you think that stems from?
Yeah, so I mean, honestly, I think my passion is, of course, for writing, but even larger than that, it's for journalism. Mm-hmm. And I really can trace that back to being almost a toddler when my father, when I was first starting to read, when I was, I don't know, 5, 6 years old, would drop off the New York Times at my bedroom door every morning as I was getting ready for school. And I was tasked each week with circling some words that I didn't know. And, you know, it would usually end up being 10 to 15 words each week. And I would add them to index cards. And those would be my quote unquote vocabulary words for the week. And the first year or so, it was really just really a word search. But as I grew a little bit older and, of course, got better at reading, I really started to pay more attention to the content of the articles. And I really fell in love with this idea of storytelling and, you know, not only storytelling like fictional books, as all of my children's books had, you know, really accustomed me to, but this idea of being a reflection of what's happening in the world. So, you know, given that it's the New York Times, it was, of course, a very large focus on international and national news, and as well as finance and all of that. But there were also so many pieces on art and style and culture. And I think that's really what prompted me to first fall in love with this form. And as I grew older and, you know, kind of got around to the middle school age and started reading a lot more literature and doing some writing of my own, I felt that it was something that I really loved doing, I enjoyed. I ended up doing it for pleasure as well as for my academic requirements. And frankly, you know, I was good at it. And I think that that being the true Leo that I am, I really like things that I'm good at. So, mm-hmm.
No, it totally makes sense. So you are a freelancer, correct?
I am. I was at Condé Nast as an editor for about a year and a half, and mm-hmm. I left in November. And while I was there, I was doing freelance the whole time, but really sunk my teeth into it a little bit more in the last, 8 months. God, I can't mm-hmm. believe it's been that long. But, you know, this year.
So how do you go about getting your... Well, I guess because you worked in Condé Nast, you had a name for yourself. But as a freelancer, you stand alone. Your work and everything is, you know, who you are, essentially. So yeah. How do you go about, because I'm not, you know, in the journalist world, but how do you get these articles? How do, like, I have no idea what that process is like.
Yeah, it's such a good question. I think a lot of people who even are in the journalism world, but who are on staff, really don't know the complexities involved in freelancing. And even though I freelanced during my time at Condé, it was such a different type of thing because I wasn't reliant on it for my only source of income. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, being at Condé definitely opened some doors, but the department that I worked in was really our special interest magazine. So we worked across all the brands, but it was only print issues, and they were kind of these almost book-like magazines. So they weren't received in the same way. They weren't in the same world that so much of my freelance work now is. So I think, you know, a lot of it came down in the early days to just cold pitching and reaching out to editors and, you know, of course, doing the research of finding who the right editor is, but reaching out to them and just saying, hey, I am a journalist. These are my qualifications. I write about this sort of thing. I would love to write for your publication. Or, of course, pitching them a specific article, which, you know, depending on the editor is a better or worse way to go. And, you know, with pitching, there are so many elements that you really have to take care of. And again, it's so specific to the editor, to the journalist. So as a freelancer, and particularly when I'm reaching out to new editors, it's kind of hard to tell, like, what they're going to be looking for. Mm-hmm. And of course, I don't want to waste too much of my time writing up pitches and emails when I'm, of course, paid to write.
Right.
So much of it is just establishing relationships. And mm-hmm. I would say that that's really where I spent my early days, doing. I do think that once you kind of have your name out there and in certain publications that have, you know, a considerable amount of clout, when you reach out to new publications, you know, and they see that you've written for XX and X, it definitely helps. It's kind of, you know, it accounts for your credibility and they know that you are at least a decent writer. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, and it comes down to ideas so much of the time. You know, you could be the best writer in the world, but if you don't have a good idea for a story, then no one's going to really want to hire you. But with that in mind, you know, I have certain publications where I am a contributor. So Forbes, for instance, I just joined as a contributor a few months ago, but that basically means that I write 5 articles for them every month. And that is kind of uniquely at my own discretion, but for most of my publications where I'm a contributor, I still have to pitch all of my ideas to my editor and get his or her okay before I can proceed and, you know, agree on a rate and a deadline and all of that. And, you know, it's hard. And I think no one really gives you a rule book saying this is how you freelance. So you kind of have to learn as you go.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes sense. I'm curious to know, because you are a journalist and an editor, and I have, breezed through some of the articles that you've written, do you think that you are able to still take an opinion approach to these articles, or do you think it's more factual? Because I feel,
that's such a hotly debated question. So I got my second master's at Columbia Journalism mm-hmm. School, and I did that part-time while I was working at Condé and while I was freelancing, and I just finished this past May. So I think, you know, having that kind of traditional education when it comes to journalism was very interesting to me to kind of face against the real world approach to it. So when you're in the classroom at a school like Columbia J School, they're really preaching the most idealistic values to you. They're saying you can never have any mm-hmm. sort of opinion. You have to be unbiased. You know, you can't do any of these things that mm-hmm. are really at odds with how the industry functions in this day and age. So I was thankful that I did that part time because it enabled me to see, you know, both what journalism perhaps should be and what it really is, and find my own kind of line in between that. But I think part of the reason I cover culture, when I first started in journalism, I was very dead set on covering politics. And unfortunately, it was right around the time of the 2016 election. And of course, in political writing, you have to be a lot more unbiased and, you know, a lot more impartial than you would in other sorts of writing, because you are, in essence, informing somebody's vote and really how the country could end up for years to come. So part of the reason I really moved away from politics was because I just found that I could not remain impartial when someone, frankly, like President Donald Trump was in the running. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm a very, very opinionated person. And I think, you know, my mother would certainly say that about me. So it was difficult for me to keep that out of it. And it almost felt irresponsible because I felt that this man was fear-mongering, he was putting out false information, and how do you remain unbiased with someone like that? Mm-hmm. So I moved away from politics, but interestingly, I found that, you know, kind of my love of politics carried through all of these other realms. So in many ways, and I think that this is really a product of the last few years especially, but in many ways, so many industries and facets of the world end up being political. You know, you can't talk about wellness, right. You can't talk about reproductive health, you can't talk about, you know, education, the arts, any of these things without kind of getting down to the brass tacks of politics. And I think in so many ways, you know, the election of Donald Trump has brought a lot more people who perhaps weren't involved in politics previously to really use their voices. And I love being able to use my platform to highlight people like that on both sides. But I think it's really important for individuals and even businesses, as we've seen in the last few months, to take a stand on these issues that are not only political, but are humanitarian.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, this world is crazy right now, and it's just, I mean, it's good and bad. I feel like, obviously, nobody wanted this whole pandemic to happen or have Trump in office, but I think when these things happen, it sheds light on so many issues and it gives us a chance to start questioning our own values, right? And start asking ourselves, what can we do to change that? Because when there's a problem, you know, it's not enough to just acknowledge it, right? It's to take action. So,
I think that's been a massive silver lining of the last 6 months. You know, like you said, as horrible as this pandemic has been, and truthfully, I would not wish this upon our worst enemy, but I think it's really exposed some of the major flaws in the American system and just in the way that we interact with the rest of the world. And that's not to mention, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement and the subsequent anti-racism awakening, which I think was really such a long time coming. And I'm so happy that much of the world is finally having the reckoning that, you know, it really needed to long ago.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. What has been your favorite article to date?
Oh my gosh, what a question. Oh, you know, that's kind of like choosing a favorite child. I don't know that it's possible to do that for me. But I think, you know, part of the reason I really don't limit myself to one quote-unquote beat is because I think that there are amazing stories to tell across industries, across different categories. And I really rely on the people whom I'm highlighting. So I think if someone has a good story to tell, I want to be the one to help them tell that. You know, I want to use my platform to help get their ideas and their voice out there. And the most special stories to me, the ones that I've loved the most, do exactly that. And, you know, sometimes they're about one individual, one company, one campaign, one initiative, or, you know, others, they're about larger trends in a certain industry. But I think it's really, that's why I love journalism. That's why I love doing what I do. And I think it's, you know, one of the most important things in the world, because it's how we're looking. It's the lens through which we're seeing the world. And I take that responsibility very heavily.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so maybe that wasn't a fair question. What, is there any articles that, I guess, gain the most exposure or attention or feedback from your peers or just out in the public that you were like, wow, this one did super well, or I didn't know it was super controversial, or one that just got people talking?
Yeah, you know, I a few months ago I wrote a story for Fortune magazine about ingestible beauty. So this idea that you can take like collagen supplements, be it in the form of a pill or in the form of a drink, or, you know, drink your retinol, anything like that, and whether or not that actually works. And it was something that I, being so close to the beauty industry, was constantly exposed to over the last few years. And I always kind of thought, huh, like, this seems like a great idea, but is there actually truth to it? Mm-hmm. Or is this all just kind of a marketing thing? So I really enjoyed writing that article, and I found that so much of like this drinkable beauty is rooted in history. You know, it seems like such a recent phenomenon, but in truth, I mean, I remember finding out that about 100 years ago, women used to take arsenic, thinking that it would make their skin clear. And of course, we now know that that was poisonous and, you know, probably contributed to horrible health problems that they had, but I just think that this idea is so interesting. And of course, it led me down this path of science and medicine that is inextricably linked to beauty. But I think a lot of people don't necessarily consider when they look at beauty as, you know, a more or less superficial industry. Mm-hmm. And that article was very, very well received. I think it wound up kind of I don't know if viral is the right word. I'm a horrible millennial. I'm like not good at tech at all. It's embarrassing. But I remember seeing that kind of all over the internet. I remember getting a lot of feedback, good and bad. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, friends of mine even reached out and said, hey, like, I didn't know this. Thank you for showing me this and shining a light on this. Mm-hmm. So that was a really fun one to write. But sometimes, you know, the articles that I think will do really, really well end up being, you know, a little bit of a miss. Right. And sometimes the ones that I'm just casually writing end up really taking off. So mm-hmm. I think so much of it is out of my hands and perhaps even out of my editor's hands, as much as we all would like to think that we know the way of search engine optimization and all of that. Mm-hmm. So it's really just up to readers sometimes.
Yeah, no, I agree. Do you also find it a bit difficult to contribute for these publications? Because I think, I don't know if it's a misconception, so you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like if I'm on one of these outlets and I'm reading an article, I never really look at who wrote it. I'm reading it for the content. So is that just me? Or do you think like a lot of people feel the same way in terms of not necessarily associating or maybe even acknowledging the writer behind it?
You know, I honestly, I don't know if I could speak to that because I've always had such a different approach being in the industry and being aware of all of the writers across so many publications that I do definitely pay attention to that. I think a lot of people probably when they're reading articles are not looking at the byline unless they have reason to. So if a story really speaks to them or if they disagree with something and want to voice their thoughts on it, then perhaps they look at the byline and find the person's email or contact info or whatever else. But I do think a lot of journalists and, you know, hopefully myself included, gain a little bit of a reputation for writing about certain things and for a certain writing style. And I know that I've certainly had readers outside of the industry, outside of PR, all of that, reach out and say, hey, I really love your writing style. Like, where else can I read your stuff? Or where can I follow, you know, everything that you write and do? And that's such a compliment because I think it's, you know, it's very easy for someone to like one thing that you do, but for them to like you that much, it's, you know, it's great. And it sucks because it's almost like a popularity contest in some ways. I think that's a big contributor in whether or not I am chosen to write something as a freelancer. But it's, you know, it is what it is. Mm-hmm.
So let's shift gears a little bit. And I want to ask you what keeps you up at night, and this can be physically or emotionally or mentally. I think given what's happening in the world, where we are all going through our own versions of how to handle a pandemic, and again, this question can also relate to your professional life, personal life, whatever you're comfortable sharing. And I ask this because I feel like as New Yorkers, we're constantly on the go. We're always putting 10,000 things on our plate. And we never take time to sit down and say, you know, what's going on with my life? And is there anything that's stressing you out? And if there isn't, that's fine as well.
Yeah, I think that's such a good question. I really couldn't agree more. I think as New Yorkers, and certainly personally, I have a major tendency to juggle a million things at once. I like being very, very busy. And I think that there are some real repercussions to that as well. So, you know, in the last week and a half, the thing that's been keeping me up at night is definitely my new puppy because he barks endlessly. But beyond that, I think the last few months have really been difficult for everyone. And as a journalist, as someone who's reading all of the news, all of the statistics, really consuming so much more than I probably should be, it's been particularly hard. And I think it's often difficult to separate the things that are happening in the news or in the outside world from what's happening in my own world. And it's especially hard to do that when all of that is really impacting my own life. So even though I might not be you know, in hospital on a ventilator right now. The pandemic has obviously impacted everybody. It's impacted us in the way that we live, in the way that we interact, in the way that we socialize or work. And, you know, I think it's impossible to ignore that. Having said that, I've always had really, really bad sleeping issues. I've kind of had mild insomnia for most of my life. And, you know, in some ways, that's been a blessing. I work really, really well at night, and I don't require a lot of sleep, which I think is, you know, sometimes a benefit. But of course, it's hard when, you know, you can't turn your brain off. And long before the pandemic started, I have always had a habit of kind of making lists in my head. And I think, you know, when I get into bed at night, it's really the first time in a day when I don't have distractions in front of me. So even if I'm working and thinking about something, I'm usually also doing something else. I'm paying attention to the emails that pop up on my computer or my phone. There's noise in the background. So when I crawl into bed, it's really the first quiet moment in the day. Mm-hmm. And as a result, my mind just starts racing and going through all of the things that I should have done in the day, need to do tomorrow, need to do long term. And I am 100% my harshest critic. I have extremely unrealistic expectations for myself. I'm very tough on myself. So I think a lot of that kind of shines at night, unfortunately.
Right. So you are basically a night owl, or do you think...
100%.
Got it. And what is your morning routine like? Or what is like a typical day in your life, if there is a typical one?
I mean, that's hard to say because I think obviously the last few months have been very atypical. But even before that, I think as a journalist and particularly as a freelancer, there is no regular day. You know, I might have my skincare routines in the morning, but really the chunk of my day is devoted to so many different things depending on what's going on. So I have a lot of meetings most of the time, even in the pandemic world, those are now on Zoom, but you know, they're still all over my calendar. And those are mostly with brands, with individuals, with editors, with PR. And it's really kind of the behind the scenes work that makes my writing possible. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of that happens during the day. And then I'd say I spend, you know, I try to get between 3 and 5 articles out each week. And I work 7 days a week. I really do not observe Monday through Friday, as awful as that is. So, you know, depending on whether I'm fulfilling a deadline or getting something out that day, I might spend a few hours writing. I might spend a few hours transcribing an interview, which is the worst part of my job. I loathe it. It's horrible. But you know, it really varies so much.
Right. Sorry, I was just thinking about like you actually sitting down and transcribing an interview.
I know, and nobody thinks about that either. Like they think, you know, journalism, editor, like it's such a glamorous job, and they see all of the beauty products that I get to try and like all of the events I go to, and you know, that's all wonderful, but a lot of it is hard work. A lot of it is, you know, very, very deep research, particularly on investigative pieces. And a lot of it is just sitting there for hours on end, transcribing phone interviews and in-person interviews. And, you know, I wish I had someone else to do that for me. I really do. But I found that nobody does it quite like I want and so much of that, you know, like ultimately when I'm transcribing something, I'm also thinking about what I'm ultimately going to write. So when I'm writing down what someone said, I'm like thinking, okay, this will be a good thing to put in the eventual article.
Mm-hmm. So as a writer, do you ever experience writer's block? I mean,
I wouldn't say I've ever experienced writer's block as most people think of it. Mm-hmm. I sometimes struggle to think of, you know, new ideas for stories, particularly if it's for, you know, a certain outlet and I know that they're looking for a very, very certain thing. I don't think I've ever, I mean, even in my academic life, I don't think I ever experienced writer's block, but I do find when I'm kind of at a shortage of ideas. Just going out into the world and really interacting with people always leads to ideas. And I can't tell you how many sticky notes I have around my apartment that are just like jotted down with different ideas that could be great stories. They could be garbage. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you just have to have, I think the best part is you do have somewhat of a creative freedom, right? I mean, there's no such thing as a crazy pitch, in my opinion.
Yeah, and you know, one of the really great things as a freelancer and one of the things that attracted me to it at the end of last year when I decided to go freelance full time is that you really do have this freedom and independence that a staff journalist just doesn't. So I think in recent years, as clickbait and search engine optimization and all of these ideas have come to be, a lot of what magazines and outlets are producing is not hard-hitting journalism. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've seen the rise of listicles thanks to outlets like BuzzFeed. And that just really wasn't what I wanted to do. So I think in going freelance, I really gave myself the ability to pitch stories that I wanted to write. And I am able to say no to assignments that I don't want to take on.
Mm-hmm. Right. That must feel great. When you look back at your journalism journey, I guess, when have you felt the most challenge?
I mean, I think challenge comes in so many different ways when you're a journalist and when you're a freelancer. I have definitely come to kind of roadblocks within stories that have been difficult to get past. I've come against, you know, some no's from editors that I really thought should have been yeses. Mm-hmm. I think it depends. I mean, when I was at Columbia, I wrote my master's thesis on the pharmaceutical industry and really focusing on the legal side of it. So preemption for medications, which is a whole other discussion. But because it was this very, very kind of hotly debated world, I found it difficult to find people who were not biased, even people who were doing this as their jobs, because I think they inevitably were on one side or the other. And with this sort of topic, it wasn't such a black and white issue. There were so many in between. So, you know, I'm obviously a very liberal person, but I don't really agree with the idea that like big pharma is always bad when it comes to a topic like preemption, because it's so much more complex than that. And when I was writing this, I really wanted to show that. I wanted to show that this Supreme Court case that kind of set the precedent for medication preemption in the pharmaceutical industry was, yes, very valid in its own right. This woman lost her arm because of a Phenergan injection. And that's horrible. And, you know, I spoke with her many, many times. Her interview is in my story. But ultimately, I think it set a precedent that doesn't really make sense for every medication across the board. And I would argue that it needs to be treated on a more piecemeal basis. But it's such a complicated world. It's such a complicated discussion. And so it was challenging to find people who could explain that in words that any reader could understand and words that I could understand, having, you know, come from a very different industry. Mm-hmm. And then for me, it was a challenge to make that digestible to my readers.
Right. Yeah. Because I think sometimes you have to somewhat write to dummies, right? Or like pretend
this is such an interesting thing. One of my favorite publications in the world is The New Yorker. Mm-hmm. And it kind of has a reputation of being the intelligence that you want.
Yes.
But perhaps
yes.
Don't have.
Yes.
So very common when you're reading The New Yorker to perhaps stumble across a word you don't know. And I think it, you know, kind of comes with the territory, like maybe you don't want to admit that you don't know it. You know, it's you're reading it as an aspiration more than a reality.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I think like it's very important to approach all sorts of writing in that way, but I don't know that every publication has that reputation or that clout that The New Yorker and, you know, a few others have.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think, you know, in picking up a copy of Vogue, you know, there's so many people across the world who pick up Vogue and who are not in the fashion world, who are not walking down the streets of New York in haute couture, but they're doing this because they admire it and they're looking up to it, and perhaps it's something that they eventually want to be a part of. Perhaps they're just admiring it from afar. So it's journalism, of course, is a reflection of the real world, and I think we have to keep that in mind as the writers and creators behind it. But it's also an art form of its own. You know, when you go to a museum and you're looking at a Picasso, you're not looking at it because it's what you see and what you believe is, you know, a mirror to the world. It's because you admire it. So I think there's definitely a balance that can be hard to strike at times, between, you know, being approachable and digestible to your readers. You do definitely have to dumb down some large ideas and assume that the average reader knows nothing, even when that might not be true. Mm-hmm. But it definitely depends on the outlet and the audience.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. So this podcast is called The City Confessions, and I don't know if you saw this coming, but I asked my guests that have come on basically what is their confession. And I know that sounds crazy because I kind of just threw that at you, but essentially I will explain where this came from, or this idea. I was really inspired by Humans of New York and Post Secret. I'm not sure if you are familiar with both.
Yeah, I love Humans of New York.
Awesome. So Humans of New York talks about stories of people living in New York, and I think it's super interesting. And then Post Secret is this guy named Frank who has a blog, and this was back in the day. Like, I remember I was in like middle school or something, but he would encourage people from all over the world to send an anonymous postcard with secrets, right? And I remember reading them every Sunday, and some of them I never, like, whatever they were going through, I never went through, but for some reason it still hit me. And I was like, wow, we as human beings are super connected, and people don't realize that. I think we tend to be selfish in our daily lives, thinking about what we have to do, think about our own deadlines, which is fine, that's part of life. But when you take yourself out of, you know, your own circle, your own comfort zone, and you take this global perspective, I just think it's interesting to see that we all have different paths and backgrounds, but there is still this similarity in terms of emotions or feelings or certain experiences. So with all that being said, I think sometimes when the guests confess something, somebody else as a listener can say, oh wow, I can totally relate. And yeah, again, this can be silly, it can be serious. It honestly is up to you in terms of what you're comfortable sharing. But if you were to complete the sentence of my confession is, what would that be?
gosh, I've been like thinking about this for a couple minutes since you brought this up. You know, I guess one of the biggest issues that I deal with and really grapple with personally is this fear that perhaps I won't be a, you know, a happy person as we think of happiness. And, you know, I, in many ways, I think a lot of people, when they look at me, when they look at my life, my career, don't really expect a lot of the things that I've been through, a lot of the things that I've dealt with. And without, you know, getting into all of that, I definitely put a lot of pressure on myself. I don't really believe that I am built to be a happy person, at least not professionally, because I am never really satisfied with whatever I do. You know, the joke in my family is that I'm going to win my first Pulitzer and I'll get up on stage and ask why I didn't win too. So I think it's, you know, I put so much pressure on myself that I think drives me and has led to where I am, and that's all wonderful, but it also kind of makes me scared that I, you know, won't be this happy-go-lucky person, that I'll be too fixated on my accomplishments.
So I guess what I'm hearing is your struggle for, I don't even know if perfection is the right way, but you definitely are a perfectionist, correct?
I'm definitely a perfectionist, but I also, I wouldn't say that it's like the pressure of perfection right. that I put on myself. I'm very, very big on legacy. And I think, you know, more than anything, my modus operandi in life and as a journalist has been to leave my mark on the world mm-hmm. and to be remembered long after I'm gone. And I think a lot of people approach that idea of legacy as, you know, having a family or doing, you know, something in their community that really leaves a mark. And well, that's all great and things that I definitely want. I really see my larger legacy as my work. And so I think, you know, the goals that I have for myself are, you know, seemingly far-fetched. They're really, really ambitious. And I don't know that I'll accomplish all of those things, but even if I do, I think I still won't be satisfied with myself, if that makes sense.
No, it makes sense. And I don't think you're the only person who feels that way. I think a lot of people do. And if you really think about it, it does come from a good place. You know, you're always wanting to challenge yourself. You're always wanting yeah. to do better. And that makes sense. I mean,
I honestly would argue that most people who are successful, you know, not just monetarily, but successful in what they do, successful in accomplishing their goals, have that sort of mentality.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. So as we're wrapping this up, I just want to take a moment now to acknowledge you as a writer and editor and journalist, and to just take a moment to thank you for being on this podcast, because from what I've learned with doing this for a year and a half now, is that time is super valuable. And you didn't know me previously, and the fact that you were still so willing to jump on and again, follow up with everything that has been going on for the past 2 months. I really do appreciate that. I think I love getting to know people, and I am always drawn to people that even without meeting them, I think there is a energy and people who share the same values as me. And again, I know I've never met you, but I can tell that you are definitely a good person, you know, at heart. So thank you so much for sharing your story.
No, of course. It was my pleasure. And I'm so honored that you thought of me for the podcast. Yes. This is so much fun.
So I have actually two more questions before we actually wrap it up. So why don't you tell the listeners what you are up to? Do you have any goals? Do you have anything that you're working on that you can reveal?
Say that last one again.
Oh, do you have anything that you're working on that you can reveal? So basically, this is like a chance for you to plug in all your what you're working on.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, I am always working on about 8,000 things at once. You know, it's definitely a symptom of being a journalist. You know, like you can't research and interview and write everything in one day. So you have to have a lot of stories and at different points in the process. Right now, gosh, what am I working on? A lot of the stuff I'm working on right now is under embargo, so okay. I can't really talk about it until it's properly released and announced. But I'm doing a lot of stories for Forbes this month that I think highlight some amazing women, and I'm really, really excited to get their stories out there. And I hope that, you know, everyone is excited to read them.
Mm-hmm. No, that's really exciting. Also, when you submit a article for Deadline, what's the turnover rate, but like how long does that take for it to be published?
Oh my gosh, it so depends on the outlet. Some of them are amazing. They'll literally put it up the same day I file, which is just awesome. Some are so bad. It's crazy. Like some take months and months before I even see it online. Mm-hmm. And of course, if I'm writing for print, that's an even longer process because magazines work 2 to 3 months ahead of, you know, what's actually coming out. So if I'm writing something for print, I won't see it, between the deadline and the actual publication for at least 3 months. So sometimes that's a tough thing to grapple with. I think part of my favorite one of my favorite parts of being a journalist is really being able to see the final product. Mm-hmm. And I take that approach in everything I do, but especially work. So, you know, waiting and waiting for that is sometimes a little challenging.
Right. Okay, so last question. What is the one thing you love most about yourself?
Oh my gosh. You know, I think very ironically, perhaps, I love my ambition and my drive. And I know that I just said as my confession that that's, you know, perhaps what will lead to my unhappiness in life. Or really my dissatisfaction, I would say. But I also think that that's really what makes me who I am. I am extremely strong and resilient and tough. And, you know, I'm certainly not everyone's cup of tea, as I've learned in my years.
Don't worry. Me too.
Sorry?
I feel the same way. Sometimes I'm like, I'm not everybody's cup of tea, but it's okay.
Yeah.
Because
I definitely rub mm-hmm. some people the wrong way, but I am kind of unapologetically who I am. And I think, you know, that is definitely reflected in my work. And as I see my work as my legacy, I really, I take that to heart.
Yes, I love that. And I think it's a great way to end the podcast. Again, thank you so much for being on. And I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. I'm going to leave all of Gabby's information in the description. So be sure to follow her and read all her amazing articles. And stay tuned for next week's episode, guys. And enjoy the day or whenever you're listening to this. All right, bye.